Was it on already?
No, it wasn't on.
It wasn't on?
Okay.
And now, here, and like this?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, okay. Good. And then interactions between these in six and seven dimensions, where the geometry of these special cycles actually illuminates the geometry of the manifolds in which they sit, and the geometry of the manifolds in which they sit obviously control a lot of the geometry of the cycles. So that's what I want to talk about basically in the third lecture. Things may not quite divide up so neatly because for motivation purposes you may want to know something about this while I'm talking about this, and I'll make those remarks, but if a remark is cryptic here, I'll try and make it less cryptic here. So I wanted to start out with a little bit of a very brief history. Kind of appropriate because this is in fact the 100th anniversary of the introduction of the notion of holonomy. So in 1899, Heinrich Hertz, in his posthumous book on the principles of mechanics in a new form, coined the two words holonomic and non-holonomic. Borrowing from the Greek, holo meaning exact and nomos meaning law, the idea was that holonomic constraints in constrained mechanical systems were supposed to be constraints that forced the particle or the state to evolve on proper subsets of the full state space. So, for example, a constraint like PdP equals zero, obviously, you know, in Rn, obviously implies that P has to move on a sphere. On the other hand, other constraints that showed up, the classic example was the case of a ball rolling on the plane. If you imagine a ball rolling without slipping or twisting, or twist, then the configuration space is five-dimensional because there's the rotation of the ball plus the contact point on the plane, and yet the allowable motions are controlled by curves. That is, if you specify the curve that you're going to roll along, that tells you how the ball is going to roll. And even though that's a constraint, it's three differential equations for the motion of the ball, it doesn't constrain where you can move in the space. You can easily roll the ball from any position in any orientation to any other position in any other orientation. So these were called non-holonomic because they didn't imply any actual constraints, any finite constraints, as they called them at that time. This was, according to the OED, this was the first use of the word. And it appeared, as I said, in this 1899 work of Hertz. Now, maybe we can argue with the OED, but that's what they claim. Okay. Jump ahead about 19 years. 1918, this really becomes the first connection with what we might call physics. I mean, what we might call general relativity. Not that that's not physical. And Shouten looked at the problem of parallel transport in Riemannian manifolds. He was actually interested in relativity, as you can imagine, but he phrased it in terms of Riemannian manifolds. And he described exactly what we now describe as holonomy, that is, parallel transport of frames along curves. And he talked about what he talked about, though he didn't use this word, he used degrees of freedom. Which for him meant if you start at a point and you parallel translate around a loop, some frame, parallel translate, you come back, starting out this way, say you come back rotated some. And he taught, he said the degrees of freedom of the metric was the dimension of the space of rotations you could achieve by parallel translating around in the around loops in the manifold. That was and he gave some examples of degrees of freedom of things with various different degrees of freedom in dimension four. And although I haven't looked at the paper, I gather that there that he intended at that point to then go on and look at what would happen in for solutions to Einstein's equations. But I don't know if that paper ever appeared. I've not been able to find it. In fact, the only way I found this paper was it was referred to in a little book by Cartan in 1925, where Cartan examined this question of degrees of freedom. That is, and let me, to be precise, put down the conditions, a manifold, a metric, G Riemannian in this case. examined this question and made a few remarks about the about what this problem about the nature of this problem. Let me make sure that I get everything right. One thing though I should say before I go on to talk about this as holonomy is that when Cartan made his original definition, he was thinking very physically. He thought the way he made the original definition was, you know, imagine your manifold here, M, and you have a tangent plane at some point, and what you do is take a curve in the manifold and roll the tangent plane around on the manifold, rolling without twisting or slipping. That basically, that was the idea. That was his actual description of it. And when you come back, I should have made sure I had some colored chalk, but I don't. When you come back, say if the tangent plane looked like that, you roll around, you come back, and you might get the tangent plane is rotated and its origin is translated when you roll around. And Cartan called that the holonomy, the set of possible motions of the tangent plane. Originally, he called that the holonomy, the motions of the tangent plane as you roll it around without twisting and slipping. And so you'll see things like in his first paper when he classifies the holonomy of Riemannian three manifolds, he says the holonomy can be a subgroup of the Euclidean motion group anywhere from zero to six dimensional. Which nowadays we would, you know, it looks a little strange because of course we think of the holonomy purely in terms of its rotation, which he later decided to do. So original definition in terms of rolling. Rolling, which gave both rotation and translation. But then he made three very interesting remarks. And what's interesting is that he makes these remarks without any indication of I will prove this later, or the reader can supply a proof, or even that it needs a proof. He just says they're true. He says, first of all, the holonomy is a Lie subgroup of the rotations in each tangent space. Should be the holonomy at x is a Lie subgroup. And now I'm going to use holonomy in the sense of just the rotation part of what he was originally calling the holonomy. Is a Lie subgroup. So he just says this. The second thing he remarks is that if the holonomy acts reducibly, then the metric splits as a product. So if whole preserves splitting on TXM, then metric is a product. And the third remark that he makes, which is very interesting from my point of view, and from the point of view of these talks, is that he says that when n equals 4, that's the dimension of the manifold, when n is 4, SU2 sitting in SO4 can occur as holonomy. In fact, he says explicitly, if you're familiar with the Cartan-Taylor language, he says explicitly, the local solutions depend on two functions of three variables, such metrics. And although he didn't have the language or any words for it, he actually makes the remark that it's Ricci flat and anti-self-dual. Like I said, he doesn't say the words, but when you look at what he writes down as the curvature identities, that's obviously what he would have said if he'd known the words. So, but he doesn't give any indication of how he derived this result. He just says it's true. And he also, interestingly enough, doesn't make any remark about any relationship with complex geometry. As far as I can tell, this is the first known explicit reference to something that we would later call Kähler manifolds, or hyper-Kähler geometry and all that stuff. And it occurs in two sentences at the end of this little book here. And as far as I can tell, Cartan never comes back to it. That's a good question. Why did he choose SU2 instead of U2? Probably because he found it more interesting, I suppose. I mean, he was always interested in the simple groups. And that's the first case that he... You know, he talks about the... You know, in the lower cases, any proper subgroup, of course, preserves the splitting. So the first interesting case is in dimension 4, and he takes the smallest thing that doesn't preserve splitting and shows that it occurs. Maybe that was his motivation. I don't know. He doesn't say. He just says it's interesting that these things exist. Right. Which raised the interesting question as to what are the possible subgroups of the holonomy in the Riemannian case. So, although that problem wasn't resolved until much later. I mean, Cartan didn't raise this question. He just says, here's an example. Well, these two theorems here, I mean, these two are now known by names. Since Cartan didn't supply proof, and you know, whether he could have or not, I don't know, but he didn't. Finally, Borel and Lichnerowitz, 1952, proved that the holonomy is in fact a Lie subgroup. And proved it in much greater generality, something I'll come back to a little later, subgroup, than the Riemannian case. Slightly earlier than that, Durham, and I didn't write down the dates of this, but it's sometime around 1940, approximately, proved the second statement, and he proved a global version of it. So, proved that if M and G is complete and simply connected. And the holonomy at X of G in the tangent space preserves a splitting then M is in fact a product. And G is a sum, where GI is a metric on MI. And each one of those is complete, and so on. And the holonomy is, in fact, The holy homonymy group is, in fact, the product of the holy homonymy of this guy, the holy homonymy of this guy, and the holy homonymy of this guy. Right. What else could it have been? A priori, it could have been some, you know, just take two generic elements in a Lie group and take everything they generate, say. Or I don't know, take the rational points in a Lie group. That's part of the thing is and it's also true that the holonomy, I mean, it can't happen in this case, although that's not so obvious. It can't happen in this case, but it can happen in the Riemannian case, but it can happen that the holonomy is actually dense. As a subset, you know, it's a dense subset of the full rotation group. And in fact, you can see that easily. Well, I shouldn't say it can't happen in this case, because it can. If you just take a cone of the right of generic angle and you look at the holonomy of parallel transport around there, it'll come back rotated by a certain number. That case, actually, it's discrete, you know, but you can imagine things where the holonomy, you know, the closure of the Lie algebra might be something weird. I mean, it's not a hard theorem, but it does take some proof. I mean, you know, to prove that a given subgroup of a Lie group is a Lie group, takes some. You have to say what topology you're going to put on it to get that to work. Sorry? Oh, preserves, that is, it preserves a splitting of the tangent space. That is, TXM, the holonomy actually preserves some V1 plus VK as subspaces. You only need it at one point. If the manifold is connected and simply is complete and simply connected, then this splitting at one point forces it actually to split everywhere and with the same number of irreducible components. In fact, that's a good point. What the holonomy tells you is that so there's the holonomy principle. Fancy. Which is that if any tensor or spinner, for that matter, that is on TXM, that is, you know, some multilinear function or spinner on this tangent space at this tangent space that is invariant under the holonomy at X, can be parallel translated and gives rise to a parallel tensor or spinner on the entire manifold. So, invariant of this is the restriction to X of a parallel tensor or spinner field. On M. So in particular, these plane fields, if you have an invariant splitting of the tangent space at one point, it just parallel translates around and gives you a parallel splitting of the tangent bundle. And then integrability, because this connection, the Levi-Civita connection, which is what I'm always taking here, I'll come back to that in a little bit. The Levi-Civita connection, if you have plane fields invariant under that, then they're actually integrable. And therefore, you know, when you integrate them, you get distribution leaves, and that's how you get the manifolds. Each one of these manifolds is, in fact, the leaf of this invariant distribution going to this point. Right. So it's this is one reason we might be interested in classifying possible holonomy groups, because that tells us what kinds of possible parallel spinner fields we can have, spinner or tensor fields we could have on a manifold. So This raises the question of what are the possible subgroups of the orthogonal group that can be holonomy. And I'm going to tell you what the answer is, at least in the simply connected case, in a few minutes. But because of later developments and things having to do with when we want to look at the case of connections with torsion, I need to look at a somewhat more general setting than what we have right now. And I'll come back to this guy. So the general picture is we have a principal H bundle over M, principal H bundle and theta connection. So it's a one form on B with values in the Lie algebra of H, a connection. And of course theta gives is determined completely by the horizontal by splitting of the tangent bundle at each point of B into the vertical tangent space and the horizontal tangent spaces at any given U. And we can look at the horizontal curves, that is, the curves on which theta vanishes starting out at U. And that's just, of course, parallel translate in the case of the orthonormal frame bundle. We can let BU of theta be the set of endpoints of theta horizontal curves starting at U in B. It's called the holonomy bundle of U. That is the set of places you can get to. And the fact is that BU theta is an HU bundle sitting inside H subbundle, and HU theta is a Lie subgroup of H. This is the general Borel-Lichnerowitz theorem for a general connection on a principal bundle. And a famous theorem due to Ambrose and Singer, whom we're honored to have in the audience, one of whom we're honored to have in the audience, is that the curvature of theta allows you to compute, which is of course, the standard formula. The curvature allows you to compute this the Lie algebra of H. So, which I don't have the date for that. That was about 1950 something. So,
yeah, something late 50s.
Late 50s. I see. So, is that the Lie algebra is actually equal to the values of the curvature bundle? I mean, the values of the curvature two form on vectors in the tangent bundle of B, in the tangent space at U to B of where sorry, tangent space at V to B where V belongs to the holonomy bundle. In other words, if you look at the possible values of values of the curvature, where the curvature goes into the Lie algebra, evaluated at points of the holonomy bundle, you actually get the full holonomy algebra. Or actually, this should be span. I'm sorry. Obviously, it's not. I mean, that might not even be a vector space as it stands, because you're doing it at different points. This theorem looks like it's not very useful. at first glance, because it assumes that you know what the holonomy bundle is before you can compute the algebra. But in fact, what this allows you to do is give necessary and sufficient conditions for something to be holonomy, as we'll see when we get to the Bianchi identities. Necessary conditions, the sufficient conditions are much more tricky. They are all conjugate. I should have said that if you take a different, I mean, it's sort of the obvious thing that B U acted on by H is actually, I think I'll get this right, H inverse B U H, something like that. Oh, that doesn't make sense. B U, it's just this, right? And the holonomy, theta's here. The holonomy here, that is conjugate, as you can imagine. So you get, although I might have the H and H inverse turned around here, it's the one that makes sense. I think that's it. They are in fact the leaves of a foliation. They foliate B, right? Although that requires proof, but it's not so hard. So in particular, up to conjugacy, the holonomy up to conjugacy makes sense as a subgroup of H, and of course all conjugacy classes occur. Now, I should say, the question of what are the possible, you might ask right at the beginning, what are the possible holonomy groups of an arbitrary connection? I mean, you might try and sort of generalize the problem by looking at what are the possible holonomy groups of an arbitrary connection on a principal bundle like this. But that doesn't lead anywhere, basically, because it's easy to show that H prime sitting in H can be holonomy, can be HU theta for some theta. And here let me take the dimension of n to be bigger than 1, because everything's trivial in the n equals 1 case. If and only if B admits an H prime reduction. Structure reduction. It's easy to see one way. If it has an H prime structure reduction, then you just take the connection, just take a connection on that structure reduction and extend it in the usual way to all of B. On B prime, extend it to B, and that'll be something that will preserve B prime as holonomy. So if it has a reduction, and if it is holonomy, then the holonomy bundle itself is the structure reduction. So topologically, there's nothing, you're playing with the net down at this point. But of course, in the Riemannian case, you're not considering. Although the bundle is the orthogonal frame bundle, the orthonormal frame bundle, you're not considering arbitrary connections. You're only considering connections whose torsion is zero. And that imposes serious restrictions on what you can do. So, however, in the case that B is actually F, the Riemannian frame bundle, things are going to be different. Equals the canonical frame bundle. Of TM, we have another consideration to worry about. Connections have not only curvature but torsion. There's the torsion to worry about. And I'll just remind you, you know what these things are. it'll help in later on in the lecture if instead of taking Rn, I take an abstract vector space because I have to keep doing because I have to keep looking at its dual to let M. And what is the frame bundle going to be? It's going to be an element in here is just going to be isomorphism with this reference vector space. And the fibers are, of course, GLM. This sits over the base point X. So the elements of this frame bundle are just isomorphisms out to some reference vector space. You can think of them, if you want, sort of one jets of coordinate systems. And this bundle happens to have what the physicists call the soldering form, or the tautological form, or the canonical form. There's an m-valued one form, a canonical. Canonical m-valued one form, which I'll call omega. And how is it defined? Well, if I take an element y in the tangent f, I just push it down by pi and then apply u to it. This is for all y tangent at u to f. This has values in M, and the object, the torsion object, you know, if you is just if theta is a connection on F, then the torsion is represented by a function t that takes f into basically an m-valued, a tangent-valued 2 form. So up on f, it's represented as Tom lambda 2 m to m, so that this structure equation holds. And if you're like me and are more comfortable with indices, I'll write this down in indices. I'll have to, we usually write it d omega I. The standard summation conventions apply, right? But I'll try to avoid writing things out in indices when I don't need to, just to let you know what's going on here, if you're more comfortable with that. And the equation t equals 0 is a serious restriction on what theta can be. Is a set of equations on theta that are not gauge invariant. Right? That's important. See, of course, the curvature is a gauge invariant. And the holonomy is a gauge invariant. All that kind of stuff is nothing. But here, because we've tied to t, you know, if you make a gauge transformation with theta, the gauge transformation will not leave omega alone, in general. And as a result, this equation sort of breaks symmetry, if you will. This condition breaks symmetry and restricts what kind of connections we can have. And now the question is, what are the possible holonomies if theta satisfies t equals 0? And that will, if you can answer that question, that will answer this question, what are the possible Riemannian holonomies, because, of course, the Riemannian holonomies all have zero torsion. So. And here's where the Ambrose-Singer holonomy theorem comes in to help you, because you see, if we take t equals 0 and we look at d omega is minus theta wedge omega and just differentiate this equation, we get the equation, you know, because d squared is 0, we get that the curvature satisfies this equation. which gives us that the curvature theta is some r omega omega, where now r, omega wedge omega, where now r takes values in Hom maps f to Hom, well, again, it eats two forms, but now has to spit out something with values in the Lie algebra. But the Bianchi identity here says that r omega omega, this first Bianchi identity, which we didn't have before, gives that equation, and that ties the, in some sense, you know, it ties the, if you think of it, r as, you know, a collection r, I, j, k, l, intuitively you can think that it ties the these two indices that are sort of what two forms can occur in the curvature to the Lie algebra, because of course that equation is nothing but r I j k l plus r I k l j plus r I k l j, gotta get l first, l j k, zero. That's all that equation is. So these first two indices that are sort of the Lie algebra indices, and then the second two indices that are the possible curvature two-form indices gives you a set of relations. I mean that are in fact quite tight. Just as an example, suppose you look at the possible different representations of SU2 sitting in the different dimensions. So look at Rex SU2 or SO3 for 8 for the possible holonomy. See, if you impose that the holonomy line there, when you restrict to the subbundle, you'll still have these equations, but now they'll satisfy by the Ambrose-Singer theorem. Well, they'll lie in the Lie algebra, and you can see what the dimension of the space of solutions of R is. So in dimension solutions, dimension of R equals 0, well, the lowest is, of course, 3, the standard SO3 representation. We know the there's six possible curvature components here. SU2 is represented in dimension 4 in the standard way, Cartan's example, and the possible curvatures, there's only five things when you put all those equations in. In dimension 5, there's only one. And dimension 6 and higher, there's none. That is, these equations are so overdetermined when you insist that the holonomy lie in SU2 for dimension 6 or higher that you just get the curvature is 0. But if the curvature is 0, then obviously you can't get the holonomy algebra. So that's ruled out. So SU2 cannot occur as holonomy in dimension 6 or above. And in fact, it's very hard for it to occur as holonomy in dimension 5, because there's only one component of the curvature tensor that survives the Bianchi identities. And in fact, there's only two cases. In fact, it's not hard to see. Up to a scale multiple, there's only these two symmetric spaces, and it's dual. SL3R. Mod SO3. Those are the only examples up to scale where the holonomy can actually, in five dimensions, where the holonomy can be this representation of SO3. It's an easy consequence of the structure equations. In this case, these are, of course, the K3 metrics. I'll call them, put that in quotes, because, of course, local solutions need not extend to global solutions. And this is the general metric. We don't get anything. I mean, we don't get any restrictions at all, other than just being Riemannian. Well, now you could, in principle, now just go through every compact Lie group. You know, if you wanted to solve the Riemannian the case of what can be holonomy in the Riemannian case, you could go through every compact Lie group, look at every irreducible representation, and list all the possible holonomies. Check at least these conditions. You could rule out a bunch of things. You couldn't necessarily say because these equations were satisfied that there was a solution. That's another problem. But at least you could rule out a lot. And in fact, Berger in 1955 basically did this. He went through in the Riemannian case and in the more general case I'll talk about in a minute. He went through in the Riemannian case, looked at all possible representations of all the compact Lie groups, and combining this with the derivative of these equations, the second Bianchi identities, combining that with that information, he was able to give a list of what the possible holonomies could be. And the list came down to, there were actually quite a lot of them that where when you solve for the possible curvatures of such a thing, you get only a one-dimensional space of curvatures. There were a lot of those. And those all turned out to be locally symmetric spaces. And so you can just sort of set those aside and say those are the locally symmetric guys. And then you look at the ones for which this space of solutions is bigger than one-dimensional. And it's important, one other thing you want to put in because of the Ambrose-Singer holonomy theorem, you need to know that when you look at the solutions, that the Lie algebra that they lie in is at least as big as the holonomy you're trying to hit. You need to know that, because it could happen, in fact it does happen, that you can take a certain subalgebra, for example, SPN, SP1, and ask, can that be holonomy? And there's lots of solutions to this equation, but they all happen to lie in the SPN part, at least when n is bigger than 1. So SP1, SPN can't occur when n is bigger than 1 as holonomy. So you can rule out things like that. It was a kind of exhausting and complicated story. He also did the pseudo-Riemannian case under the additional assumption that it was that the holonomy acted irreducibly. And that you have to put in extra because the Rahm splitting theorem doesn't work in the pseudo-Riemannian case. That is, and let me rather than me just copy the list up, let me put up a little transparency and make a few remarks. For n bigger than 1, yes. Yeah. I mean, it turns out. That's SPN. Oh, did I say SPN SP1? I should have said SPN times S1. Sorry. That's what I meant. S1 is U1 sitting inside, you know, as a subgroup of. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said SP1. Let me put up this list. Do not put the screen all the way it sticks. Somebody has to stop this, I guess. I'm going to say a lot more about the bottom entries in this list later, but Dave essentially mentioned this list already last time. This is, after you take out the locally symmetric examples and you look at only the irreducible holonomies that preserve a quadratic form, this is now known to be the list of possibilities. The top two grouped together are the generic metrics and the generic holomorphic metric. The next set are the generic Kähler metric and the generic special Kähler metric. The next set are the sort of generic pseudo-hyper-Kähler metrics, which is, that is, hyper-Kähler but with possibly split signatures. The next one are called the next group, this group here, are called the quaternion-Kähler metrics, or it should be quaternion-pseudo-Kähler, I suppose, and then a couple of different real forms of the same, the holomorphic version and then a different real form. And then two sort of funny examples in dimensions 7 and 8. G2, its non-compact dual, spin 7, one of its non-compact versions, and their complexifications. Those are the things that can occur as irreducible holonomies. Now, it's a long story. It's a bit of a long story exactly how we got down to this list. Berger, as I said, produced a list. That list was longer than this. It missed this guy sort of by small oversight, you know, little things like that. But it was longer than this. He included things like spin 9 in dimension 16 and so forth. And it was realized a little later that, in fact, Berger should have eliminated spin 9 because it didn't actually satisfy the criterion that I was listing. It only occurs as a symmetric space. Jim Simons, in I guess it was 62 or something like that, went through and found a much more conceptual proof that these were the only possibilities in the compact case, in the Riemannian case, one that didn't rely on the classification of all the compact irreducible, the representations of all the compact Lie groups, but went more conceptually to what these equations actually mean. Although, interestingly enough, his proof included allowed spin 9, which turned out not to exist. So, anyway, you'll notice kind of an interesting thing about this list, which is that a lot of the things, once you get past the, these are things that preserve spinners, actually. And the others are defined by, of course, the unitary group, as you know, is defined by preserving a two form. These are defined by preserving a certain four form in those dimensions. And in fact, as I'll explain later, G2 and spin 7 are also defined by stabilizing certain three forms and four forms. But they also are characterized by preserving certain spinners that I will, and I'll get to that point. But that is the list. You know, after you go through this analysis, it's basically, and you can do it by brute force this way. There are cleaner ways, but that's what we know now. Now, one thing I haven't explained is what these things mean, let me do that before I go on to talk about the two modifications of the holonomy problem that I want to. I should also mention one last thing. I'm not going to put the lists up, but Berger also partly classified the cases where the holonomy acted irreducibly but didn't preserve a quadratic form. That's a much longer list. It's a much more complicated list, and it has some beautiful exceptional geometry in it that for some other time.
Robert, one comment.
I think
a critical observation at the time was, at least in the Riemannian case, and when we eliminated the symmetric spaces, that all these groups act transitively on spheres.
Right.
And then very quickly you can write down with them.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, that was Jim Simons' crucial step was to prove that if it could occur as holonomy and wasn't locally symmetric, then it had to act transitively on a sphere. And so you could quickly write down what those possibilities were, as you said. And then, yes?
In the irreducible case, there seems to be another
entity symmetric. That's not quite true. There's, at the very top, there's SOP1. For example, in dimension p plus 1, when n is p plus 1. Oh, yeah. Oh, none of the special ones. That's right. None of the ones with reduced holonomy can be Lorentzian. No. That's right. Not in the irreducible. Not in the irreducible. That's critical. Right. Although you can certainly have things with two negatives. They occur in the second grouping. Right. Right. And the first grouping, of course. Well, actually, yes, I'm considering only the identity component of the holonomy group at this point, right? So, which is the same as just computing the holonomy for the simply connected cover, right? Yes, right. Because otherwise, I'd have to do things like put in a plus or minus spin 7 here, say. Plus or minus G2.
Right.
By finite groups, exactly. That's right. Actually, the extensions can be more complicated than that. It's possible for the there are examples of non-compact Riemannian manifolds, non-compact and complete Riemannian manifolds, obviously not simply connected, whose holonomy has an infinite number of components. Yeah, this was discovered recently. It had been an open problem for a long time. And people had conjectured that the holonomy of a complete Riemannian manifold was always a closed subgroup of the rotations. But in fact, that turns out not to be the case. Sad to say. Oh, yeah. That's right. But fortunately, there can't be. Fortunately, most of these have very few extensions by finite groups. For example, spin 7 only, not inside SO8, for example. There's nothing between spin 7 and SO8. Not even an extension by finite groups. Whereas G2 has an extension by finite group, which is to add plus or minus the identity, because G2 doesn't contain minus the identity. And that's the only extension it has. The others are more complicated, of course. I mean, things like this SPPQ actually has, because it has that commuting SPP1 that's lying around, any finite subgroup of it can occur.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. For example. Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Let me turn this off and get back to my story. So I'm going to talk more about the geometry of the G2 and spin 7 guys in the next two lectures. So and also the SU3 case, which I understand is of primary importance, is of great importance in what you guys are working on. But what I want to do in my remaining minutes is talk about two related problems that are of some interest in special dimensions. One is, as Gary said, what about Lorentzian cases where the holonomy does not act irreducibly, where the holonomy preserves a null plane field. If the holonomy preserves a non-degenerate plane field, replace null by degenerate plane field, but of course if it preserves a degenerate plane field, it'll preserve the maximal null guy in it. If the holonomy preserves a non-degenerate plane field, then the Durham splitting theorem goes through just as before. That is, you can just split things off and locally it's a product. But you can easily have things where it preserves a null plane field, say a null line, and doesn't preserve any complement, and the thing doesn't split. It can even happen that it preserves a null line and a complement, and it still doesn't split. Those kinds of, the Durham splitting theorem just fails utterly as soon as you have things like this, these null subspaces. And I have to say that this is an unsolved problem. In all dimensions, in general dimension. We know, of course, plenty of solutions in dimension four. I mean, the relativists became interested in this very early on and wrote down solutions. We know lots of those. In fact, we know from what Gary said a few days ago, we know how to write down things sort of in general form when it preserves a null line in the Lorentzian case in dimension four. But in higher dimensions, you can get some very interesting and subtle things. I just want to remark. Let me remark on one thing. You can write down a form for what it looks like, but then classifying what the possible subgroups of the maximal subgroup that preserves a null line, trying to determine which of those subgroups can be holonomy can be tricky. Yes. Oh, I assume that it acted irreducibly on the tangent space, right? But in this case, you know, if the holonomy, you know, on the light cone, if it preserves some null line, say, then it doesn't show up in that list. And in fact, we don't know what all the possible subgroups of the subgroup of ON1. ON1 preserving a line, that maximal parabolic. We don't know what all the possible subgroups of that maximal parabolic are that can be holonomy. However, physicists probably aren't interested in solving that general problem. I'm guessing. One thing they seem to be interested in particular, is the case where there are parallel spinner fields. And in a case like in a case like this, what happens is that, you know, if you're looking for the ones that preserve, say, that have a parallel spinner field, if the spinner field is sort of in general position, if it's algebraically general, then that will force, as Gary said, a splitting, actually, because it'll force some preserved non-degenerate plane field. But here's an example. This is an example that you may be interested in. If you look at SO10-1, if you look at SO10-1 and look at its cover, spin 10-1, as you know, spin 10-1 sits inside SL32. SL32R. And spin 10-1 actually preserves a quartic form on this, preserves a quartic form. A quartic form on R32. That's the only invariant polynomial polynomials in it. Let's call this quartic form Q. This quartic form is, in fact, greater than or equal to zero, and although I can't draw it in space properly, we're in R32. The null cone Q it acts transitively on the punctured null cone. Transitively on the Q equals 0 minus the 0 set itself. And it basically, and it acts transitively on the non-zero level sets, and the non-zero level sets of Q, and the positive level sets. And so if you're asking for a manifold of dimension 10-1, a Lorentzian manifold of type 10-1 that has a parallel spinner field, there's actually sort of two possibilities for parallel spinner fields. There's the parallel spinner fields on which Q is positive, and the parallel spinner fields on which Q is zero. Right. Now, the parallel spinner fields on which Q is positive, that causes a splitting right away. What that does is, the algebraically general spinner. The stabilizer of that is SU2 sitting inside the spin, sitting inside the SO10. I mean, SU5 sitting inside the SO10 part. And so as a result, it stabilizes a time-like line, and you get a product of Calabi-Yau dimension 5 with a trivial time-like, a translation invariant time-like vector. On the other hand, the Q equals 0, you can have parallel null spinners. And this is more equations than the equation to have a parallel null vector. If you think about it, to have a parallel spinner, you're fixing a point in a 31 dimensional orbit, whereas here you're fixing a point in only a 10 dimensional orbit. I mean, if you're trying to have a parallel null vector. And in fact, you can write down what the solutions look like. And I'll say maybe in my last lecture what how you come to this. But I just want to say locally, they look like this. The metric is, whoops, got the wrong page. Where is the right page? Well, that's the trouble with having too many pages. That's not it. Ah, here we go. Locally, the metrics look like this. You can choose coordinates so they look like -4. dx1, dx3, plus dx2 squared, minus 4g, dx3 squared, plus, I'll call this, what Gary was calling dx perp squared, I'll call this eta dot eta, where it looks like this, g satisfies this condition, it doesn't depend on x1, and locally the metric looks like R2 cross R cross, I'll call this manifold M8, where coordinates x1, x2, x3, and no coordinates here. Y if you want, although I won't write down coordinates, where G doesn't depend on X, and eta is a certain X3 parameter family of spin 7 metrics on M8. So to have a parallel null spinner, forces you to actually have it forces there to be this sort of one parameter family of eight dimensional spin 7 manifolds, sort of lying in the yes.
You haven't imposed any
Einstein. I haven't imposed Einstein yet. That's right. Yeah, yeah. This comes out just from knowing that the holonomy is in the stabilizer of this. Stabilizer of this null spinner. Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's in this dimension, you can square a spinner and get a vector, and so you just square the spinner and take the Lorentzian norm, and that's two quadratic things, and that's why you get. What's not so obvious from that point of view is that the square of the spinner always goes. Actually, my Q is the negative of yours. The square of the spinner when you turn it around, basically that vector is always future directed, light like or time like. Right. But that comes out of the geometry. I'll say more about how this is proved later on. But the picture that I want to point out is that this, you know, even if you're only interested in 10 plus 1 dimensions, these spin 7 geometries can show up even without. Now, typically, I know what people do is look at, you know, they want there to be a parallel spinner. They don't want things to split necessarily, and typically, though, they impose more constraints and actually get a product anyway, and get down, you know, actually split off a couple of dimensions from this M8 and get down to a Calabi-Yau and so forth. But that's something you have to add in by hand beyond the parallel spinner. Now, that's a sample of the kind of thing that I'll talk about, particularly in lecture 3. I just wanted to say something. Oh, yeah, you can. I mean, these spin 7 metrics, spin 7 just means the holonomy lies in spin 7. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. It could be flat, right. You could actually certainly have flat. But what I'm considering is sort of what's the general form of having a parallel spinner, parallel null spinner. Right. Yeah, I have only one supersymmetry. That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's the... This is the minimum that you can and still have supersymmetry, right? It's the lowest possible, right? Which is, I understand, is sort of the thing that you think things are more likely to exist if you have the minimum possible, right? As long as it's positive, is that right? Okay. Yeah. In the last few minutes, let me just remark about this one other. There's a modification of this holonomy problem that has become of interest lately. Well, maybe it's been of interest a long time. I've become aware of the physical interest of it lately, which is that that if you look at, if instead of throwing out the torsion completely, you put restrictions on the torsion. So, generalized problem. The generalized problem is to solve this. That is, we don't insist that there's no torsion. Gijk. Oops, I jk. But we do insist that we want this. Second, we want a Gij, omega I, omega j, that is theta parallel. That is, so the connection should preserve a metric, call that G. And the three form, tau, that you get by lowering this index, G I L T L J K, omega I wedge omega J wedge omega K, we want, let's see, let me get the indices right here, that's a half. We want this lowered guy to be fully anti-symmetric. Tijk should be minus Tjik, and of course it's skew symmetric in the other guys. And we want tau to be closed. This tau, I believe, is what they call the H field. That is, we want to look at pairs metric plus three form with the property that you have this structure equation, the torsion, the three form gives the torsion of a connection that's compatible with the metric, but is not the Levi-Civita connection, of course. And we want to know what are the possible holonomies. Such. Now, a long time ago, Cartan and Schouten actually looked at this problem and classified the case where the holonomy was trivial. They gave a list of what the possible solutions are when the holonomy is actually when this connection theta is actually just flat. And they found that there were basically two kinds of solutions. There was the case of the left invariant parallelization on the Lie group, and the three form is the so-called Cartan three form, the thing that generates the invariant guy. And if you look at the seven sphere with its standard almost complex, seven sphere with its standard G2 structure, it has such a connection. And the canonical three form, I'll talk about that later, except that it doesn't satisfy d tau is zero. It leaves this aside. They actually solved the problem without assuming tau to be closed, but if you take tau to be closed, then the only solutions are products of Lie groups. That's if the holonomy is trivial. Cartan and Schouten. Solved the case. Holonomy is trivial. It's actually a very remarkable paper. It's by no means obvious. The proof is very subtle. very tricky. But you can now go back and ask what are the possible holonomies in these things. And the one thing you find out, first of all, the first thing that goes haywire is that the Drom splitting theorem goes out the window. The holonomy can be trivial, like it is in the Lie group case, and the metric's not a product. Nothing's a product. The second thing to remark is that you don't actually find any restrictions on what the possible subgroup can be until you get up fairly high, until you get up to dimension 6. Every single closed connected subgroup in dimensions 2 through 5 that can occur they can occur as the holonomy of such a system. So there's lots of those. However, things get more subtle and more interesting when you get to dimensions 6, 7, and 8. And since those, oddly enough, seem to be the dimensions that the string theorists are the most interested in, I hope to talk about that some in the final lecture. Okay, so I think I'll stop here and continue tomorrow.